Welcome back, murder friends, to
Under the Influence of True Crime. That's Kate, and she's telling our story.
And that's Em, and they're under the influence.
Very much so.
And you guys might be like, holy shit, you guys sound good.
Oh, shit, really? Oh, I'm blushing.
Yeah, you guys sound really good.
Wow.
But why?
Who knows?
Well, thanks to our dear friend and sponsor, Anchor. We are now coming at you with two microphones.
Two brand new microphones. Plus just like all the cool shit that we need to sound good.
I know. I was like, there's more. It's nuts. Just y'all wait.
Truly, I know y'all hear the ad every episode, but like, thank you so much to our sponsor, Anchor, for everything.
You should... 1% of our listeners are in Thailand.
Hell yeah.
Yeah.
What's so up, Thailand?
I guess since that was all of our business, we should get the show on the road.
I'm going to keep stalling, actually.
Oh, you don't want to hear this case?
No, I don't.
Well, this week, I'm bringing you the case of Maddie Clifton.
Dun, dun, dun.
And I would just like to preface this by saying, this case is
full. It's bad. This is the kind of case that my family members who listen come up to me a couple days later and they're like, "Em, what the fuck? That was so hard to listen to." And I'm like, yeah, that's why we have trigger warnings on stuff, actually.
Quite literally, which, speaking of, the trigger warning for this week is brutal murder of a child, child-on-child violence, sexual implications towards a child, and some seriously fucked up shit, dude. And also throat slitting.
Slashing?
Yeah, there's gonna be some slashery.
And that's the end of the episode. Goodbye.
I wish I could confirm that for you. Unfortunately, that is not the end of the episode.
I'm upset about it.
It is only the beginning.
It's only gonna get worse from here.
Quite literally. So, buckle up. Alright. Are you ready?
Ready.
Fantastic. Let's get going. I want to start this case by talking a little bit about who Maddie was, obviously. Madeline Ray Clifton, Maddie Clifton, was born in 1990 in June as the second daughter to Stephen and Sheila Clifton. Maddie was 3 years younger than her sister Jessica Clifton, and by all accounts, they were a really happy, super cute family. The Clifton family resided in a really nice neighborhood in Jacksonville, Florida. And with it being the 90s, the children spent a ton of time playing outdoors. They played with neighbors and they were just, you know, dudes. They're just being kids though. And like, I know for like me at least, and I'm sure when you were a kid, like I was outside a ton with my neighbor kids.
Right.
Like the friends that I had in my neighborhood or people I was out with. Like I lived in an actual subdivision with every house around us having kids.
Yeah.
And I know that you live in the middle of...
Literally lived on a farm with the only person to play with was my brother and my cousin who lived down the road.
Okay, so yeah, I kind of understand this one a little bit. Well, but like genuinely, like we would all just be outside and like riding bikes somewhere in the neighborhood.
Right. No, like we would always be outside like together and like my cousins who lived down the road would always come over. Like we would always have friends over and stuff, but not how you did.
You know, that was just something you did. You were outside a lot as a kid and you were out until somebody called you for dinner and you came home.
Like, right.
You know, that was when it happened. No one could text you and be like, all right, you gotta come back by 7:30. Like, you just...
This is, like, the kind of thing where they would be, like, be home when the road lights turn on.
Right? Like, yeah. Exactly. You know, that was something that Maddie enjoyed doing as well. She played for the YMCA soccer team, and she was the number 5. She was also known to hang out with her friends down the street and their older neighbor, who was 40, which a lot of people misconstrued in the first, like, coming out of this story. And they would hit golf balls with him. Like, that was...
It cute.
Was, he had kids that were a lot older, and so they were just hanging out with him. And it was... Maddie was never alone with him, which was what a lot of people thought, and so they kind of got a misconception about their parents, and that was something that Jessica cleared up in her really awesome interview that she did with Morbid.
Jessica, her sister, for anyone who got lost
yeah,
in the
sauce. Yeah, sorry. I mentioned that earlier, and then I was like, better keep up, boys.
And, like, also you had to think that, like, a relationship like that, they're thinking of, like, hey, let's go down, because he would probably be, like, a father figure, like, an uncle figure. Or...
Yeah, they're like, cool, we're not worried about where our kids are. They're with an adult hitting golf balls.
Right. And some cares? Right.
And they knew he was a dad. He's a parent as well. Like, people tried to make it like he was just this creepy 40-year-old neighbor who was just hanging out with this 8-year-old little girl alone in his yard. And that wasn't the situation at all. Like, Jessica, she says that they were never alone together. It was usually her, their friend Jeff, their friend Justin, and their friend Nick. And so, you know, that's a big group of people. And I just...
And it just doesn't give you the vibes of anything weird was going on. Like, they just... It was this older guy who probably missed his kids.
Literally.
And these girls who thought he was fun, like, thought of him as, like, an uncle or something
like
that. Yeah,
it was, like, a whole, you know, whole group of kids. And they were like, this is cool. And he lets us hit golf balls at things.
Right.
And that's... I know if somebody let me hit golf balls at something, I would show up any day. Except for to go play golf. I absolutely will never do that. If it's for real golfing purposes, you count me out of that.
Mini golf?
Well, that might be different.
The golf's smaller, you see.
Oh, would you say it's mini?
I might. So like I said at the beginning, obviously child on child violence, you know, you guys probably didn't miss that. And you were probably like, what? Well, that is because the killer of Maddie was in fact another adolescent child. And I want to make this episode a little bit different by also talking about him. So I am going to talk a little bit about who Josh was before this happened. So Josh Phillips was born in 1984 to parents Steve and Melissa Phillips. And like Maddie, Josh was the younger sibling, but his home life was really, really different from the Cliftons.
So he was born in 84. When did you say Maddie was born?
90.
Okay.
So at the time of her death, she's 8 and he's 14.
Okay. That's what I was wondering. Yeah.
And this is actually where I did want to talk about Josh's home life a little bit and that it was pretty rough. And in doing that, we wanted to acknowledge that it's possible to feel bad for someone in their youth and their childhood because of their bad experiences and abuse and still consider that person to be a bad person later because of their crimes and their actions.
Right. We're not sympathizing with a murderer. We're not sympathizing with someone who did this. We're sympathizing with a child who lived through this.
Who endured abuse in
exactly
the developmental parts of his life. You know, no one should have to do that, regardless of, you know, what happens in their later life.
Right. It's, like, you can feel remorse for a child, but not for what they turned out to be.
Yeah. You know, we feel bad for what, you know, Josh went through in terms of his childhood.
Just keep that in mind, too, because I think it's hard whenever you're listening to a story like this and you, like, start to feel bad and you're like, oh, what the fuck?
Like, wow,
I can't believe they had to go through that. Sucks. But then, like, also
don't forget what he did.
Right.
So we're going to talk about it because it wasn't just a really quick thing and, oh no, I don't have time to think about this and this is just really hard. Like, there's a lot of extenuating circumstances in this that ultimately lead to Josh being a bad human being.
Right. But we can still show empathy for the child.
Exactly.
Okay. Yeah.
So just keep that in mind. Technically, after this happens, Josh is tried as a big kid, and he is not considered a child any longer. So.
Right. So at that point.
Adult crimes, adult times.
I think
what I'm saying?
Everyone here kind of is on our wavelength. I'm sure they all know what we're talking about.
Right. I think you guys can.
And if you have any questions or want to discuss it, send us a Gmail.
And if you disagree.
Send us a If you disagree, still leave us a 5-star review wherever you listen.
Thank you.
So Josh did really have a bad home life, especially, you know, according to him and his mom. He said he feared his dad, who had a really bad temper, and he was an alcoholic. So one rule that was pretty important to his dad, and in particular important to this case, is that Josh wasn't allowed to hang out with friends when his parents weren't home, and he especially wasn't allowed to hang out with little girls.
I kind of understand that.
My thing is that's a really weird rule, and I feel like it definitely contributed to how fucked up Josh, like, was, and, like, how he viewed, you know, girls, maybe?
Oh, no, the not being able to hang out with friends while the parents aren't there. Like,
oh.
That was
no,
that what I could sense. Kind of understand.
You waited until after I said he couldn't hang out with little girls, and you went, I get that.
I just didn't want to interrupt your sentence. Sorry.
I was like, what?
Why? No.
Anyway, completely.
Fuck gender stereotypes.
That
guys.
It contributed to, like, how he viewed girls, and so it was pretty weird. And his mom, Melissa, actually said she often wondered why her husband had such a hatred towards little girls.
Ooh.
And that she just went along with the rule. And that sentence in itself made me very uncomfortable. So yeah. I thought I would share it with everyone.
Just the way that was worded.
So on November 3rd in 1998, it should have just been a regular ass day for everybody. But instead, it changed two families, destroying at least one in the process. For reference for everybody, Maddie was a really, really small child. She was
small.
4'5" and she weighed 58 pounds and she was 8 years old. Maddie had been playing outside with some of the neighbors after she had finished her homework, and Jessica was still inside playing piano and finishing up because, you know, she was 11. She had more homework and stuff to do. So Maddie had been with a couple of kids in the neighborhood at the last house on the street with that neighbor, Larry, that I had told you guys about who they would hit golf balls with.
Right.
Unfortunately, Larry was like, listen, guys, like, you can hang out and you can keep hitting these golf balls, but I'm not going to keep supplying them because shit's expensive, so y'all gotta start bringing your own golf balls.
I understand.
And they were like, that's actually pretty reasonable. So they went down to their own houses to go get the golf balls. Maddie was walked home by her neighbor, Justin. Like, a lot of people have a misconception that she had been, like, walking alone back from his house, but that wasn't the case.
Even if it was the case, this is the time period where that would have been totally normal. She was still in her neighborhood.
The implication was more that Larry was the last person to see her.
Oh, okay. Okay, gotcha.
So she didn't she was with Justin, who was 14, and he walked her home. Unfortunately, Justin got tired of waiting for Maddie while she was inside looking for the golf balls, and he told her he would meet her back at Larry's house. That would be the last time her family would see Maddie.
And you really can't blame Justin. It's a 14-year-old with an 8-year-old. I understand.
And that's, even Jessica talks about this. She said it really messed Justin up because he obviously regrets not waiting for Maddie.
Right.
You know, it's just a really shitty feeling because she said it took him down a really dark path for a long time. You know, he was 14. He didn't know that this one time he didn't wait. Somebody, you know,
you gotta imagine the, like, guilt that comes with that.
Exactly. And it's just, it's really heartbreaking. She said he's in a better place now, right? Not like a better place, but like, he's doing better.
Because, like, you, worst case scenario, I mean, really any scenario, he probably wouldn't have been able to stop what happened. Maybe, but like, the same thing would have happened to him too.
Well, the thing is if he would have been with Maddie, who's to say when Jessica didn't walk out? You know, it's the right thing is, it just would have solved the problem for that moment. I don't know.
Right.
It's no, just interesting. I know. So this is when Jessica suspects Josh was able to lure Maddie inside, because there are some discrepancies with Josh's story and the evidence, and so obviously there has to be a little bit of filling in the blanks, and so I'm going to use what Jessica, Maddie's sister, is fairly certain happened.
Okay.
So Jessica did an interview with Morbid, like I said, and it has a ton of great info. You guys should all listen. Where she talks about how it was confirmed Josh was outside doing chores, which a neighbor grandma saw, and Maddie went up to Josh and asked if he had any golf balls. You know, she just wanted to play. She literally to get back to hitting golf balls. And actually, and this is another big discrepancy, because everyone says that Maddie, Jessica, and Josh were friends. Jessica and Maddie were not allowed to hang out with Josh. He had told them a really inappropriate and sexual joke, and they told their parents, who expressed that they couldn't hang out with him anymore because that was uncomfortable.
Good choice, parents. Like,
exactly. So this is where she suspects that Josh informed Maddie that he had one in the house and that they were gonna go in and get it. And we're gonna get into what Josh says happened in just a second, but you know. So pretty soon, Maddie's mom calls her for dinner and no Maddie comes home. They send Jessica out on her bike to run, you know, bike up and down the street calling out for Maddie. Still nothing. And this is when it's apparent nobody knows where Maddie is. And that evening would begin the 7-day search for Maddie Clifton. Yeah, it's a week-long affair, which is awful. So that week, Jessica explains, was one of the worst of her life, obviously.
I imagine, yeah.
She spent so much time looking for Maddie. The entire town, state, and country, really, was coming together to search for her, and that included the entire neighborhood. There were hundreds of volunteers out every single night, and the week-long event was described as a circus, with the National Guard coming in to search for her, too.
Shit.
Yeah, it was pretty intense, actually. So the streets were silent. No one had heard from Maddie. Missing posters were being handed out, and we're actually going to post a picture of her missing poster, and there was just no word. However, on November 10th, just after the Cliftons had finished recording an interview, their neighbor, Melissa, otherwise known as Missy Phillips, ran over hysterically and grabbed a police officer.
That's not good.
It was not good. The narrator confirms.
Yeah. So she led the officer to the bedroom of her 14-year-old son. And I want to go back to what she experienced for 1 second, which Em hated earlier. So.
What Kate's about to tell you literally makes me shiver.
Yeah, it's not fun. So Melissa had gone upstairs to clean her son's room. She had noticed there was quite a stench coming from it. Mm. And, you know, she thought she'd grab some laundry, maybe throw away some old food and get rid of the smell. You know,
because he's a 14-year-old boy. That's like the first thing you like.
Literally.
Yeah. Do you know how many times my brother's room like actively smelled like death when we were growing up? Like, yeah. You just don't walk in on that. You just hope you never have to go in there.
Right. You have, if there's a teenage boy in the house, you just avoid it.
Truly. So instead, what she discovered was that Josh's waterbed had a leak in it. Remember, this is the 90s? He did have a waterbed. She began to investigate, and when she saw the frame was broken, she saw a little white piece of cloth sticking out. And that's when Melissa wrapped her fingers around this little piece of cloth and pulled. And she was like, oh, it's a sock. Well, then she readjusted to get a firmer grip and felt toes inside of that sock. And that emotionally ruins my whole life. So you should know.
I can't even express the physical reaction I just had to that.
Yeah, because she's pulling and there's a small foot in this little sock. Melissa discovers the bloody and bludgeoned half-naked body of 8-year-old Maddie Clifton entombed in her son's waterbed.
This is one of the stories that makes me nauseous.
It should, because it's horrible. I couldn't imagine seeing that, first of all, as a parent and knowing your 14-year-old did that.
Yeah.
Naturally, she was absolutely horrified. She had been part of the search parties for Maddie, and she had no idea she was so close or that her son was the one who took the life of this little girl. Incredibly, and I'm really, really happy for her for doing this, she ran to the police rather than pretending she hadn't seen Maddie, or rather than trying to just protect Josh and doing something stupid. She was like, no, this is out of my hands. Hello, officer. I'm calling the police.
Chris, is that a weed?
Calling the police.
Like, I'm glad that she... I mean, I can imagine as, like, I'm not a parent, but as a parent that your first instinct has got to be, like, to protect your kid.
Right.
And I'm glad that the shock factor of what she found didn't cause her to not act rationally, you
maybe
know?
Like the scene been... in front of her overpowered that, like,
right,
it was,
because this could have been a totally different story.
The police left the Clifton's house immediately and went to investigate, and that was when the family was notified that the search was over and that Maddie Clifton's body had been recovered. Police left the Phillips house and drove to Josh's middle school, where Joshua Earl Patrick Phillips was taken into custody. This is where we get the story that Josh had about a week to come up with.
I don't give a fuck what he has to say.
Well, unfortunately, we do have to hear.
I understand.
So, and I am obviously treating his story with extreme skepticism because, as Maddie's sister points out, the evidence doesn't fit the story that he created.
And also, how many times do we have to say, like, you were the only person there, just tell us what the fuck happened?
Literally, like, it's done.
And we, no one believes his fucking story even for a second.
So Josh claims that Maddie came over while he was outside and asked to play baseball. He says he said okay, and that they went to his backyard, and they were throwing the baseball to each other when he hit one of them with a bat, and it sent it back and hit her in the eye.
Immediate red flag, considering that one, they were not friends. She wouldn't have actively went to try to play with him whenever she was having fun somewhere else with someone that she played with often and with a group of people, and True. She was obviously having fun, and she only left to find more things to go play with.
She literally was looking for golf balls. She didn't pick up a baseball and go, I'm gonna go see if Josh wants to play baseball.
Right. Like, oh, I'm gonna go where the only person on the block not playing is.
The only person I'm not allowed to hang out with on the block.
Right.
Because he said something weird to me and my sister.
Maddie wasn't gonna, that's fucking. Ugh.
It's insulting that that's the story that he is still portraying as the truth.
Truly.
Jessica describes the backyard that Josh has. It's wicked small. She says it's kind of an odd shape and that the pool takes up the majority of the yard. Ooh. There are 4 corners of grass space around the pool, obviously. So we've got like the square.
Right.
And it's just big old thing, little patches of grass.
And that's it.
Yeah.
unless they were standing about an inch apart, they weren't playing baseball in his backyard, unless they were hitting it over the pool. Like, that's...
If you're gonna kill someone, maybe come up with a better fucking story that actually makes sense. You had a week to think about it.
So, he says that he hit her with a ball that, you know, he hit the ball and it went back and hit her in the eye. And so she starts crying really loudly. And he says this is where he panics.
Sure.
So his dad was an alcoholic with a bad temper. And he says when Maddie wouldn't stop crying, he dragged her into the house. Which, I don't get that. Because your dad is like, you can't have people over when I'm home. So you brought her inside of the home?
You were worried that she was crying and your dad was gonna hear, so you brought her into the home?
Because his dad wasn't home yet.
Right.
But he's gonna be home soon.
Right.
You're insane. Anyway.
Well, obviously, yeah.
Literally. So he drags Maddie into the house and into his bedroom. He says this is where her shorts and underwear slid off while
slid off.
Yep, just right while he was dragging her.
Just fell off.
Yep.
Okay.
However, this is not supported by the evidence. There is no sign of sexual violation or assault evidence on Maddie, but there's also no dirt, grass, burns, anything to suggest that she was drugged through an entire backyard and house.
Also, the story just doesn't make any fucking sense on its own, regardless of the evidence.
Truly. It was also discovered that he had been watching violent rape porn half of an hour before he murdered Maddie.
Oh my god.
Like, and that was discovered in his resentencing trial that's gonna happen in 2017, but, you know, it's still important to the story, so we're gonna get it in there a few times, so just buckle up.
That's gross and intense, and I didn't like it.
Well, and some of the porn that they think he was watching featured underage people, so.
That's good. So that's on the internet.
Yep. So he had a well-known infatuation with Jessie Clifton, which was confirmed when he stole a picture of her in a leotard, and they found that in his room.
Ew.
Yeah. He had broken into their house and stolen a picture of her in a leotard and took it home with him.
What the fuck?
Yeah. And for a while, he had hid behind their house with a cordless phone that was theirs and, like, racked up $500 worth of, like, sex phone calls. And they had to, like, disconnect the phone completely.
What the fuck?
Like, this kid was not okay.
He needed therapy.
More than therapy. Jeez.
True.
So he dragged Maddie all the way into his bedroom. And he says this is where he began hitting her with the baseball bat to stop her from screaming.
That's, you know, I want someone to stop making noises, I
hit them.
Physically harm them, yeah, so that they stop crying about
right.
it.
Right. He said he didn't want his dad to know he had had someone over while his parents weren't home. And this seemed more manageable to him. Her blood everywhere? Yeah. Beating her with a baseball bat. So naturally, she became unresponsive and he shoved her under his bed. He went out to the family room when his dad came home and he had a full conversation before he went back to his room. He went back and heard Maddie moaning softly from inside the bed frame because she was very hurt and obviously very scared. But she was still alive.
Oh my god. Poor baby.
Yeah. I know. So, what happened to Maddie? You know, that's the worst part of it all. He discovered her still alive under his bed, and he removed the mattress. He pulled out his Letterman, which he used to slit her throat and stab her 7 times in the chest.
Oh my god.
And I don't care what kind of fear he says he has of his dad. This is senseless and insane and upsetting. And he just covered her back up with the mattress and moved on.
You can't even say it's a trauma response or in any way trauma related. This is fucked up. Like, this is so fucked up.
Like,
he is such a fucking monster and you can't try to blame that on anything.
No,
it's
like,
what the fuck?
It's genuinely just horrible. And no matter the situation at home, that doesn't excuse his behavior. And
we're gonna feel bad about the abuse that he was receiving before this, but then like that shouldn't have happened. But also, how many people are abused and they don't kill 8-year-olds?
A lot
that just go to therapy.
I would say probably most, actually. I'd say the number is probably leaning in the more not than do.
Anyway,
well, he didn't seem to find this super concerning.
No, of course not.
His dad was the more terrifying problem, not
prison
murdering his neighbor.
Right. Okay. I totally understandable.
So he covered her back up with the mattress and Maddie was officially dead. For the next 7 days, Josh simply ignored the problem inside of his bed frame, participating in the community searches for Maddie and spending every night sleeping over her body while she decomposed underneath his bed.
I'm upset. I'm not okay. So, I'm like in physical pain.
I know.
I have a fever. for now.
What's really notable is Josh had multiple opportunities to stop and come to his senses.
Yeah.
But instead, he made the conscious decision to murder Maddie.
Oh my God.
And this is something that Jessica talks about that barred him, or that separates him from the rule that, you know, condemned the act of putting juveniles away for life without parole. She said it didn't matter in his resentencing because this situation wasn't the same and he had so many opportunities to stop. It wasn't accidental, it wasn't quick, and it wasn't any of the situations that impacted that law. So,
and not to mention, like, you're 14, you're old enough to know what it means to, like, you understand what life
is. Literally. And so
you understand there's fucking consequences for murdering people.
Well, and he was gonna have to pay them, and that's why the courts did decide to try Josh as an adult both times. Adult crime.
Precisely.
So on November 19th, just 10 days after the discovery of Maddie's body in Josh's waterbed, Josh was found guilty by a grand jury and would be tried as an adult for such a heinous crime.
Good.
The court was moved out of Jacksonville because the notoriety of the case and the jury was assembled. So the attorney refused to talk to Josh and he would only play chess with him when they would meet. And this is something Melissa really resented, but she couldn't argue with her husband. He was really controlling. And the attorney also neglected to call any witnesses on the stand on behalf of Josh, which ultimately led to his conviction.
It sounds like the lawyer knew that he was guilty and was just there because he was forced to.
He was like, we're just gonna ride this out, buddy. Let's go.
Yeah, like, there's no getting you out of this.
Truly. So during the trial, evidence continued to clash with Josh's story, and the realization of how horrible it was came to light for everyone, and how horrible Josh was. Josh was found guilty and sentenced to life without parole at the age of 15 to the relief of the Clifton family.
Thank God.
And in prison, Josh took education courses and he actually became a paralegal. He helped, I don't know why I'm saying it in past tense, he's still alive. He was helping other prisoners with their appeals while working as a tutor for the inmate. He plays guitar in a band, participates in Christian religious services, zazen, which is a Buddhist meditation ritual, and yoga. And I don't think he should be allowed to do all of those things.
Like, listen, I'm a very big advocate for prison reform and that these, like, that people should be going in there to get help and to be rehabilitated. Not people who murder 8-year-olds.
Yeah, they're not.
They can fucking suffer.
Yeah, so that's for people like, who, you know, do petty crimes. It's, you know.
Right. I was really hoping that, like, you know, like, courtyard vigilantes were gonna get him.
Nah, what dog.
The fuck?
He's still kicking. So during his 2017 appeal, the prosecution acknowledged that Phillips had been a model prisoner. As of 2008, he declined to write an apology to the Cliftons. He said that they deserved an apology from him in person, and they wouldn't believe his sincerity in a letter. Her mom said that she has absolutely no interest in meeting with him, and that she doesn't want to talk to him at all. Jessica said she almost met with him in 2008, but it didn't end up happening because he had begun filing appeals claiming he wasn't being represented properly during his trial, like he wasn't defended properly. His attorney said it was a bad time for them to meet, like it just wasn't a good idea. And later she says in the resentencing she was relieved she didn't meet with him, especially once she learned about how creepy and obsessed with her he was and potentially still is.
Right.
You know, who knows?
I gotta imagine that it's gotta be so hard because I feel like if someone were to like murder you, I would want to look them in the eyes and be like, fucking explain yourself.
Like
I would want an explanation. But, like, also, I wouldn't want to give them the satisfaction of that.
Well, for Jessie, she wasn't allowed to sit in the trial the first time, right? Because she was 11.
Right.
So, she said she learned for the first time details about her sister's death when she was 16.
Oh, that sucks.
Yeah.
That
sucks. So, she said resulted in a lot of therapy, obviously. Right. I mean, she said another round of counseling sessions. And then, her going to the resentencing was her as an adult. You know, she said it was the worst 4 days of her life because she sat in there and even stayed when they were going to show the crime scene photos, even though they were like, if family would like to leave, like, you can. And she was like, I had to know. And she said she had no idea how centered in the case she was and that it really, really fucked her up. And
I so imagine.
I was like, I couldn't imagine having met with him and being like, I just gave him something else that he probably wanted.
Because you got to think that that's part of it, was he was trying to get to Jessie.
Exactly. And so that's
really scary for her and for everybody. In 2017, Josh would be resentenced because of the creation of a Supreme Court ruling that made it unconstitutional to sentence juveniles to life without parole. In the resentencing, Josh was given the same penalty, but Jessica says this was one of the first times she was, you know, allowed to see all the things and that it was awful. It was just horrible and it was the longest 4 days.
I imagine.
The judge saw the reasoning of the original sentencing. He, you know, saw such a heinous crime against a literal child.
An 8-year-old girl.
And agreed to life without parole. And I want to do a couple of quotes here that were from Jessica and then her mom. And the first one is from Jessica, and she says, "I can tell you as a child, much like you were, when you took my best friend, I lost my childhood too. I lost my mom, I lost my dad, and I lost myself." So they also talk in this, the discovery of how aroused he had gotten while killing Maddie. The violent porn he had been watching, and his sexual obsession with her older sister.
He physically makes me feel bad. Like, he makes me feel physically icky.
Yes. The prosecutors actually made the case that they were fearful he would go after Jesse next if he was let out of jail.
Absolutely, he would.
Because they have no idea what his intentions are. You know, he's just been sitting, stewing, doing whatever.
And studying law.
Paralegal shit, bro. There was also the idea that if it had been her outside first, then it would have been her, which I just think must be so awful and terrifying to her, you know, and it must be really eerie.
It feels like he was definitely outside waiting for her. Maddie came out instead, and he was just like, well, that'll still get me close to her.
Like, what a creep. So another quote from Jesse is, "There is no reason I believe. I just can't bring myself to think that you should ever be able to walk outside of prison because she can't. It's just not fair, and you should have to pay the consequences for that." Damn. Maddie's mom hits it with, "Should he ever be released from prison, I pray I will no longer be on this earth, because I know deep down inside he was after Jesse, and I can't bear to lose another daughter." And so that broke my little, I have like goosebumps all up and down my legs.
No, I, yeah.
I am heartbroken. That, anyway. So unfortunately, Jesse says that when she was 14, her parents got a divorce, which ended 25 years of happy marriage. She said they got married at 21 and didn't even start having kids until 30 because they just loved each other. She says there's no doubt in her mind it was because of Maddie's murder, and it was because they grieved totally differently. She said her mom was drowning in it, but her dad was like, "Hey, we have another daughter. Like, we can't get lost."
And yeah, you gotta imagine this is just gonna absolutely rip people away.
Correct. She says the relationship with her dad today is still really strong, and the one with her mom is a lot less because her mom really has been swallowed by her grief over Maddie.
I understand.
And it's so understandable. And it's just, it's really heartbreaking, and, you know, our deepest condolences go out to this entire family. It really was ripped apart because of some awful 14-year-old.
It was slimy and disgusting and stinky.
Well, I think that's wrong.
But, like, this is why we do stuff like this. Like, this is why we're doing this, because, like, the victims' voices deserve to be heard. Like, that's the point of this. That's why we're doing this.
So, you know.
Thank you for ruining my night. This fucking sucked.
Yeah, I was like, that was the really, really awesome case of Josh Phillips being a piece of shit.
The amount of times I just, like, I just was speechless through this entire thing.
I would look over and she'd just have her jaw open, and I was like, oh.
Because, like, I literally speechless.
This case is literally just sucker punch after sucker punch.
Literally.
And, you know, Jessica hit it the best when she talked about how that week was awful because, you know, there was still kind of hope.
Right.
And that it was just shattered after.
Yeah, you have to. You have to hold on to the hope, or else what are you doing?
And so, you know,
That's like the same thing that we talked about in the Hart family, was like, there's just a tiny piece of me hoping Devontae's just going to show up one day. Like, you just have to have that little bit of hope to go through.
So yeah, that was basically my entire thing. Was just to ruin your guys' day, night, whenever you're listening. I'm here to ruin any time of day.
I hated it.
Well, thank you so much.
No, wait, no, I hated it.
Yeah, I heard you. You loved the case.
I hated it.
Okay,
wow. I would genuinely rather have died than listen to this case. This case just makes me nauseous.
I understand. I had some pretty bad.
It's like when you did dreams. The Catherine Knight.
She's.
And it just makes me she's nauseous.
She's slimy as well. I get that.
They're both stinky, slimy little slugs.
Don't you ever insult a little slug.
I was so stressed out this entire thing. What the fuck? Okay.
And they even know the case really well. So
I do know the case.
This is really funny.
Yeah, no, I do know the case really well. Just like every time I hear something about it, I'm just like, I can't write. wrap my head around it.
I can't lie and say I'm not glad to get this out of my brain now. I mean, it'll never leave,
though. Into our brain holes. Mine and yours, friends.
It'll never leave, though. This is one of those cases that just, like, sits with me, and I just think about it
sometimes. It's always in the back of your head. So, we will post lots and lots of pictures from this case on our Instagram.
At Under the Influence of True Crime.
We will also post them on our Facebook group.
At Under the Influence of True Crime.
You can send us an email.
At Under the Influence of True Crime.
@gmail.com. And you can rate, review, and subscribe.
Anywhere you listen to your podcasts. Like, anywhere.
I know we say that every time, but listen.
But, like, you really can.
You can do it.
You can do it.
You can do it. We believe in you.
And if you do it and you send us a DM, like, screenshot of it, we're going to send you a high five back.
Hell yeah, we are. Also, if you leave a funny enough review, we will most likely read it on the air because we like to do that.
Or we'll post a screenshot of it on the Instagram.
Oh, yeah.
Get on the gram, baby.
Hey. Thank you so much for listening. We will catch you right back here next week for some more spooky
tales. Peace.
Good night. Dudes being guys.